This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. More than 45 million Americans currently live under the poverty line, but one author argues that despite the numbers, many people still don't understand what it's like to be poor. Linda Tirado became famous last year when she wrote a response to a question that someone posted online: why do poor people do things that seem so self-destructive? At the time, she was a young mother of two who had recently returned to college and was working two part-time jobs. The post detailed what her life was like and how her family reacted to the pressures of being poor. The essay has now inspired a book. The book is called Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America, and Linda Tirado is my guest and joins us now. Hello, Linda.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us about this post initially. Kind of what was the question and where did it get posted?
Yeah, it was kind of on an obscure corner of the internet. There's a message board that I frequented, and a friend of mine basically said I was at the grocery store and I saw somebody with food stamps and an iPhone. It was that old chestnut. And she said, I know that I shouldn't be too judgmental about that. Like, I'm, you know, fairly liberal. I understand that there is stuff there, but I don't, somebody explain it to me. Why shouldn't I be mad? And I was home from a shift that I was supposed to be off at 9 and wound up having to close the restaurant. And it had been a really rough day at work. And I was like, I know this one. So I fired off a response. And the next thing you know, kind of the whole world read it, and it exploded.
Well, tell us about the response.
You know, it was really interesting. A lot of folks, I took some heavy criticism from people. Mostly their arguments seemed to be, but you're so articulate, you couldn't possibly be poor. Or you're so, you know, quick to be able to speak, you can't possibly be poor. Nobody with skills like yours could be poor.
Tell us what, so tell us about that. What situation were you in? And that you put that in the post, right? So it was a fairly lengthy answer.
I am wordy. Yes, I am verbose.
It was kind of, you had to get that down to become a book, right?
I mean, I just cut the essay in like half and we put it out. It was an immediate response of people saying, but you're not allowed to say those things, right? Because I talked about, I'm a smoker, and there are reasons for that. We self-medicate. We don't have access to those kind of medical care things. And people immediately were like, well, have you thought about the impact? Yes, honey, we've thought about the impact. Thank you for your concern. But, you know, more than that, actually, I had an overwhelming response of solidarity from people. One of the things I like to point out, and I'm very good about doing so, is that I am not representative. I am indicative, which is to say that you cannot put millions of us in a nice little box and say, this is what poor looks like. I am my own person with my own personality and my own background. And so I respond to these things in my own particular fashion. And I had a lot of people call me or write me and say, you know, I don't do it the same way you do. And I said, yeah, absolutely. Nobody's going to do it the same way. But the point is that we all work the same jobs and we go back to the same houses and we live the same lives no matter how we react to those pressures.
Well, having made that sharp and articulate distinction between being representative and indicative, now you can tell us your story and we'll understand that you're now trying to represent the whole of poverty in America. But do tell us a little bit about your story growing up in Utah.
Actually, I grew up in Michigan until I was 12. My dad worked for DuPont. My mom was a preschool teacher. And then we moved to Utah when I was 13. I graduated from high school when I was 16. Ran as far away from home as you possibly could, like you would if you were going to college, and promptly did about as well as you would expect any 16-year-old on their own at college to do. At a certain point, I became estranged from my parents, and I thought I would take a couple of years once I realized I wasn't ready for school. I wasn't mature enough. I couldn't handle it. I was a kid. And I realized that I was taking out these loans and throwing good money after bad. And I thought, well, I'll just take a couple of years off and work, and then I'll go back to school when I'm ready and I have some idea of what I want to do with my life. And that is where the trap kind of started. And as I aged, it became harder and harder to get back into school. And I started getting trapped in kind of more constricting work. And then the economy tanked and it was game over.
Maybe you can read a section of the book that talks about this kind of descent into poverty.
Yeah.
Oh, do you have it?
Tell me the page. I've got a...
Well, I believe it's page 49.
49 it is.
No. Actually, here, I tell you what. Why don't we do this? Why don't we go to page in the introduction?
I think
that might be pretty good. So it's page XXI, which you know from your Roman numerology is 11, in the introduction, and starts with, I slid to the bottom.
Yeah. I slid to the bottom through a mix of my own decisions and some seriously bad luck. I think that's true of most people. While it can seem like upward mobility is blocked by a lead ceiling, the layer between lower middle class and poor is horrifyingly porous from above, and a lot of us live in that spongy divide. I got here in a pretty average way. I left home at 16 for college, promptly behaved as well as you'd expect a teenager to do, and was estranged from my family for over a decade. I quit college when it became clear that I was taking out good loans to no good effect. I wasn't ready for it yet. I chased a career simply because it was the first opportunity available rather than because it was sensible. And I also had medical bills. I had bouts of unemployment. I had a drunken driver total my car. I had everything I owned destroyed in a flood. So it's not just one or the other, nature or nurture, poor or not poor. Poverty is a potential outcome for all of us. This is a huge societal problem, and we're just starting to come to grips with all the ways that a technological revolution and globalization have vastly increased equality. You cannot blame your average citizen for those things, nor can you blame individual companies. It's how we collectively have decided to do things.
Linda Tirado, reading from her book, Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. XXI, of course, is 21, not 11. Well done. So this passage, it seems to me, points to an interesting question and a critique that I'm sure you hear often. And so, like, well, this is your problem. You made these mistakes. You didn't get through college. I get it. But why should I worry about that? Yeah, you're poor. You made a bunch of mistakes.
Yeah.
You didn't finish college. You got medical bills. Why is that my problem?
It's almost like we're going to keep needing a service class whether or not they all go to college. And it's also, I like to say, look, if you put 10 decent jobs in front of 1,000 people looking for work, you cannot blame 990 people for not bootstrapping it a little harder. I mean, you can look at them and say, listen, if you just wanted it more, you totally could have made it. And that's a true thing. If you'd been a little more skilled, a little more prepared, a little more something, but you know you're going to send home a bunch of unemployed people. And if that's the system that we're going to set up, then no, I don't take responsibility for the parts that are not my own. I will take responsibility for my own decisions. Some of them have been short-sighted. Some of them were immature. Some of them are just bad because not all of the time am I perfect. And I will totally cop to that. But you can't tell me that post-2008, my failure to get back into school is somehow entirely my fault. As though when people succeed, it's all on them, right? And when people fail, it's all on them. But you know what? You didn't build that, and neither did I. None of us built this. We do this together. This is a society that we have created, and it does not have the opportunities that we need. And until we've set up a society in which it's really hard to fail, you can't blame people for sometimes failing. If we had it set up to where, like, look, you have socialized education, you have socialized medicine, all you have to do is show up and get through your classes, then you can look at me and say it's a bad decision to drop out of school. But when you're saying don't take on debt that you can't afford, don't get yourself into risky financial situations, and oh, by the way, we're going to need you to take $30,000 of debt out the second you turn 18 to get through a college degree that you're not sure is going to be useful in a field that you're not entirely sure that you like when you're not mature enough to get through classes, sweetie, I made the best decision I could leaving school.
I'm going to leave it at that, although I will say, I mean, that was certainly well put, and I think the best possible answer I've ever heard to that sort of thoughtless critique that says somehow it's your fault, and also the $30,000 in debt that you would have to take out if you went to a state school for 2 years, because if you go to any other school for more than 2 years, it's going to be more than $30,000, is debt only because you weren't smart enough to be born into a family that could pay cash.
I mean, it really was incredibly short-sighted of me, and I should have thought ahead. I mean, look, I already said I make terrible decisions. I don't know what anybody wants out of me.
And the other thing is that without having that backdrop, without having been born into a wealthy family that can afford to invest and not work as hard because other people are working to make their investments pay off, not having been born into that family, every nick and bump in the society that doesn't have a kind of safety net is something you feel. You wrote in your book about the struggle with your teeth, which is something we may not think about, but it was important. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was hit by a drunken driver years ago. And I was unaware that when they gave you the check for the car, that was like the whole check, right? Like that's all you get. There is no more. So when it turns out a bunch of my teeth on my back were cracked in that I hit the dash really hard. And I called the insurance company and said, I need to go to the dentist. And they said, oh, we already gave you the check. And I have no medical insurance. I have no dental insurance. And so I kind of hoped for the best for quite a few years. But as it turns out, once they're cracked and open, they will start to decay. And there are, again, millions of people living with this because we do not consider dental care the same as medical in America. And that's actually like classism from way back from when dentists were barbers and they were different than real doctors. And that is actually the basis of why I cannot go to a doctor and say my jaw is swollen and infected and I'm running a fever and I cannot think straight. It's not considered a medical problem. No matter what happens to these tissues in your face, it's not medical because back in the day, barbers were dentists.
And not having teeth or having poor dental work can have a huge impact on your fitness for work and certainly your perception when you go to sit down for that interview. I mean, in a thousand ways that we may not have thought about, that's not a small thing.
And that's without its reflection on your self-perception and your self-image. Because when you see somebody missing teeth, and here's what I got actually a lot on the internet, are you so damn stupid you couldn't even brush your own teeth? Because that's clearly the only way we're going to come by any problems, right? And to have people to know that that is the assumption that people make about you before you've even really opened your mouth does a number on you. It's why I called the book Hand to Mouth, because I do not smile without my hand over my face. I have not for years. I go out of my way to talk with my mouth closed, and that's a skill that I've actually like developed. And there are so many people, if you walk around, look at your grocery store, look at how many cashiers are talking like with their mouths kind of closed. It's because they don't have access to dental care and they're ashamed of what you might think of them.
So talk more about this first question. This, you know, if you're poor, if you're on food stamps, why should you have a phone? You have no right to an iPhone if you're poor. I mean, that was really the upshot of that, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a super good idea to have everybody legislating everybody else's personal choices. Like, everybody in America can get behind that. Autonomous adults are not a thing that we agree with here. Secondly, it's super easy to get a job without a phone number these days. So really, if you want somebody off food stamps, let's make sure that they have no email access. Let's make sure that they don't have a phone number. And those job offers, sweetie, they come to your door and say, would you like a job today? And all you have to do is say yes. I mean, it's a magical world that people live in where they say, you don't need a phone, you're poor. You need a phone more if you're poor. If you're wealthy, and I can tell you this, I'm on a book tour now, they have cars pick me up from my hotel, take me to the radio station, then there's somebody that's going to drive me back. All of my logistics are taken care of. When you're poor, you're constantly having to call everybody. Hey, I'm going to be late on my electric bill. Hey, I'm going to be 5 minutes late to work. Hey, can you switch the shift because the babysitter called? If you don't have a phone, you die. And honestly, the phone thing, it gets me because on the right, you hear a lot of complaints about this Obama phone, which is a Reagan program. It's one of my favorite bugaboos. The Obama phone is a Reagan program because we wanted poor people to be able to find jobs.
And now ever more, because phones are really marketing devices more than communication devices. If you've ever had a conversation recently, iPhone to iPhone, you'll notice you can't hear, but lots of ads, you know, easy access to purchasing. It would be even, you know, more sensible to get one into the hands of every particular potential buyer. But this question comes up. It went viral. People were asking you questions. You received a lot of criticism. It gets fed by the media. You know, Fox does this expose on how poor people have too many luxuries. You did a shout out to The Daily Show for outing Fox on its.
Oh, it was
on
such
its
a beautiful segment.
Well, let's take a listen. We'll start out with the Fox expose on how the poor are bleeding America white, and then John Stewart's response.
Food stamp abusers feeding on taxpayers. America's poor are actually living the good life.
America's culture of dependency.
Our liberal government is teaching our kids to be takers instead of makers.
Moochers. Parasites.
Sucking off, you know, the nipple of the government.
Freeloading. Draining this society.
99% of them have a refrigerator.
What? You know, I don't think I'm going to finish this milk today. I'm going to put it back in here until tomorrow. It's good to be the king.
What about that? All these luxuries. Well, let's talk about the other side of it, about federal programs that are, you know, sort of the federal trough people are. And that it somehow saps the will to succeed and to do well. You just don't want to work
anymore. I've often found that having the, like, just a little bit less food than I need to survive is the thing that makes me think, you know, what I don't want to do is improve my situation in the slightest. No, I mean, it's a ridiculous assumption. Look, it's you don't get on food stamps and suddenly have magical money raining from the sky. You get a couple of $100 a month that you can spend on food at your grocery store, right? And so you hear all of these people saying, oh, I saw somebody buy, like, real food that I might want to eat with an EBT card, and I don't approve, because clearly we should all be eating lentils and slop to begin with. And secondly, it's impossible that somebody graduated from high school or had a birthday or had an anniversary or was just doing something nice for their family that one time. That never happens to poor people because we are exempt from celebrations. You know, and so you get these critiques and they're just silly on the face of it. And what they all come down to is dehumanization. They all come down to you aren't good enough to have that. And the point that I like to make is point me out an American that does not take money from the American government. Find me that American. Bring them to me. I would like to bow down and worship them, please, because I don't believe they exist.
If you own a house and you have a mortgage, you're taking money from the government.
If you have a business lunch, you're taking money from the government. If you have capital gains, you're taking money from the government. If you drive on roads, you're taking money from the government. If you breathe, you are actually breathing subsidized air that the government has helped clean. There is nothing you can do in America that is not taking federal money in some way or sort. It's almost like there's a social contract where we've gotten the society and we all kind of went in on it together and we all benefit or something. It's, I know, a crazy new thought.
You know, the other interesting thing is that there seems that part of the critique was that you were actually middle class and too smart. It strikes me that actually proves the point and maybe why the critique is so fierce, how easy it is to fall from middle class these days to poverty, which
Look,
I don't
parents,
know.
Yeah, my parents were are fairly middle class, yeah. And no, I wasn't raised in generational poverty, but you know what? I was going to be the first one to graduate from college because that wasn't really a thing that you needed to do in my grandparents' generation. My dad worked for DuPont. He's not rolling in cash, and I didn't have his money. My fall was because the economy did not work for my generation. There are so many of us that are overeducated working in the service industry, right? And these are not jobs to raise families on. These are not jobs that fuel the American dream. These are jobs that fuel the American machine. These are jobs that fuel the American banks. These are the jobs that fuel capitalism. And it would be really, really nice if they would look at us and say, thank you for fueling capitalism for us, because it's working out really well for us up on the top.
Well, you cannot get a financial profit unless for some way that you're extracting part of that hour of labor from the worker. You can't get it. There's no profit. Otherwise, it would be a fair exchange. So
precisely.
You're sitting there waiting for your quarterly statement. How is that not? But here's the question. So we're having this robust debate about structural change. Is this book prompting that, or are we just sort of, sort of fighting over the edges of this book, do you think?
I think that the book is part of a larger thing that's happening in America. I think we see workers actually walking out of minimum wage jobs. None of those people can afford to lose their jobs. None of those people can even afford to lose a shift. And they're doing it anyway because that's how bad it is. You see people coast to coast doing this. You see people coming out of the woodwork to say, this is bad. This is wrong. This is un-American and it will not stand, because in America, we value a hard day's work no matter how low the work. There is dignity in it. And to have so many people coming out and saying it, that's why I think my essay received the attention it did. I think it's why the book is doing well. And I think it's because it's all part of a broader voice that's coming out. We are not going to tolerate this forever.
The book is Hand to Mouth, Living in Bootstrap America. The author, Linda Tirado, my guest on The State of Things, going to be reading from her book at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham at 7 o'clock tonight. Thanks, Linda.
Thank you.
Coming up, absurdist comedian Tig Notaro. Stay with us.